This is KBOO Portland, listener-powered, non-corporate community radio.
We're proud to be here with our allies in the fight for affordable health care.
I'm Andy Seaton, KBOO News.
For KBOO in Portland, I'm Julie Sabatier.
KBOO's Afifa Ahmed Shafi reports.
I'm Stephanie Potter, KBOO News.
KBOO's Eduardo Villanderos Fiede has more.
I'm Annalisa Hummel.
And I'm Liam Delta.
This is Maddie Bowden.
I'm Alex Collins, KBOO News.
I'm Michael Newman, KBOO News.
I'm Courtney Dillard, KBOO News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, if you vote in a partisan primary election in Oregon, you can no longer help nominate independent candidates. The Washington State House passed a bill banning discrimination based on sexual orientation, and a water pump failure has killed more than 100,000 trout in Northern California.
And in the human cost of occupation in Iraq, as of today, there have been 2,229 officially acknowledged deaths of American soldiers, with as many as 48,000 others wounded. IraqBodyCount.org reports 31,676 civilians have been reported killed by military intervention in Iraq. Last year, the medical journal The Lancet reported as many as 194,000 civilian casualties, not counting Fallujah, since the invasion.
Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Monday, January 23rd, 2006. I'm Andy Seaton.
And I'm Noah Eaton. The life of an independent political candidate in Oregon just got tougher. If you vote in a partisan primary election in Oregon, you can no longer also help to nominate an independent candidate. Before the new law, any registered voter could sign a nominating petition for an independent candidate or attend a nominating convention. Proponents say they want all candidates to compete on an even footing. Critics say the dominant political parties want to reduce the risk of spoiler candidates, such as Ralph Nader, affecting close races. Concerns about Oregon's nominating process surfaced in 2004, when Republican and conservative groups hoped for a Nader candidacy, believing he would hurt Democrat John Kerry. These groups encouraged their members to attend the Nader nominating convention and sign nominating petitions. The person potentially most affected by the new law is State Senator Ben Westland, who might drop his Republican Party label to run for governor as an independent. To get on the ballot as an independent, he must gather signatures from at least 18,368 voters. However, those signatures now must come from only those voters who don't cast a primary ballot.
On January 19th, Portland activists arrived in Caracas, Venezuela, for the World Social Forum. They are scheduled to visit several social justice organizations throughout the country. KBOO's Robinette Jones reports.
After 3 months of grassroots community organizing, the Portland Central America Solidarity Committee, PCASC, raised enough money to help send a delegation of 25 local activists to the 6th annual World Social Forum. The World Social Forum is an open and democratic space where thousands converge to learn, share, and discuss alternatives to the current global economic system. In a break from tradition, forums will be held at 3 points around the globe. In Bamako, Mali, festivities began January 19th and will end today. The Asia Forum will take place in Karachi, Pakistan, starting in March. The PCAST delegation will be attending the forum held in Caracas, Venezuela, from January 24th through the 29th. However, delegates arrived 5 days early to explore Venezuela's Bolivarian Revolution and the cultural and political transformations it has inspired.
El 23 de enero, huge barrio of over 300,000 people in the center of Caracas. It's an amazing place for a long time before Chavez and this new revolutionary government came around. This neighborhood has been the center of progressive poor people's movements in Venezuela. It's really exciting. The people here are amazing.
That was PCASC's coordinator, Danielle Denver. He and the other delegates are being housed in the same neighborhood as Nelson Santana, a Venezuelan muralist who visited Portland this past fall. During his tour, Santana painted murals for union offices and conducted workshops with local youth organizations. Dan Che of Portland's Metro Murals was invited to be a member of the delegation by Witness for Peace. He will be collaborating with Santana on a mural project in Caracas.
I looked at a wall today. I'm going to talk about doing a mural, they say Monday, but the conflict in the schedule so we're still trying to work it out. But we're planning on working on a mural that will be about 47 feet wide and probably 8 feet high. But we're trying to involve the entire community in the process. There's supposed to be a film crew coming out to film that when we get everybody together.
The delegation's itinerary is filled with activities that take place all throughout the country.
So today was our first day with community radio. It's a true community radio station. It's not just representing the community. It's coming from the community. One thing that they showed me reminded me of the Cable Youth Collective. All of these kids from the neighborhood would just come in and rap on the air and got to put together their own show. Like with live rap music from the neighborhood's kids. Tomorrow we're going to Maracay, and then the next day Valencia to meet with union leaders from the UNT, the National Workers Union, which is the radical Bolivarian union here. And then on Monday we come back. We're going to all be live on TV here on Vive TV.
After her first 2 days in Venezuela, Washington State University student Yasmin Rodriguez reflects upon her experiences in Caracas thus far.
I'm so excited and shaky talking about it, but yes, this is what has gone so far, and this is just the first day. So, and more excited for the World Social Forum when we're there. And I don't know what to expect, but I'm sure it's going to just blow me away, and we'll be more than happy to share this with you guys when we head back.
Upon returning from Venezuela, delegates will share their experiences in a community report back on Saturday, February 18th. For more information on PCASC or the World Social Forum, visit www.pcasc.net.
The executive director of the Portland Aerial Tram Project resigned Friday, that according to the Oregonian newspaper. The tram is an elevated people mover that is slated to be built between Oregon Health and Science University and the South Waterfront Development. The tram project has been controversial because of its massive cost overruns. The construction cost was originally approved at $15.5 million. The current estimate is $45 million, and that estimate is still rising. In an interview with the Oregonian, the outgoing executive director, Vic Rhodes, said he was leaving because City Commissioner Sam Adams demanded he do so. Adams, who oversees the Portland Office of Transportation, says Rhodes should have been warned the City Council about the tram's cost overruns. Rhodes retorts that Adams is looking for someone to blame. Lewis and Clark College professor Jack Bobgangowski has been reporting on the tram story on his blog at bojack.org. He favors canceling the tram project and worries that Rhodes' resignation will reinforce the city's commitment to it. That because commissioners might think they have solved the tram's problems by changing its manager.
Oregon voters ultimately may influence what the city of Eugene can or cannot do to acquire land on behalf of developers. City officials say they don't want to use eminent domain to acquire land for a proposed shopping, office, and entertainment complex on Broadway Street. They say they will try to help developers and property owners reach sales agreements that developers have so far been unable to accomplish on their own. But officials haven't ruled out the possibility of using eminent domain either. And that's where a ballot measure could come in. Oregon's in Action, a property rights group, is circulating signatures petitions for to put a measure on the November ballot. The measure would prevent governments from acquiring land from one private property owner and selling it to another private property owner. Currently, there are no laws preventing governments from acquiring property under eminent domain and then selling it to a private property owner as long as the project is associated with some kind of public benefit.
The Washington State House on Friday passed a bill banning discrimination based on sexual orientation. The vote sends the measure to the state Senate, where it failed last year by a single vote. The measure would add sexual orientation to a state law that bans discrimination in housing, employment, and insurance. Businesses with fewer than 8 employees would be exempt. Lawmakers voted 60-37 to approve the bill. 16 states have similar laws. Governor Christine Gregoire, a Democrat, has said that she will sign the bill if it reaches her desk. Republican Representative Don Cox said some lawmakers were concerned the measure could result in lawsuits against people who do not realize a person they failed to hire or fired was gay. The proposal failed in the Senate last year by one vote. However, Republican Senator Bill Finkbeiner announced earlier this month that he would switch his vote to yes, all but assuring its passage.
The Albertsons supermarkets have been bought by an investment group led by the retailer SuperValu. Purchase price, $6.3 billion in cash and stock. and the assumption of $6.1 billion of Albertsons debts. The purchase will make SuperValu the second largest supermarket chain in the United States with 2,656 stores. Only Kroger, which owns Fred Meyer, will be larger. The Albertsons name will be retained for stores the SuperValu is buying. Albertsons has 31 stores in the Portland area. Albertsons currently employs about 144,000 people nationwide. SuperValu would not predict whether or not there will be any layoffs. As part of the deal, Albertsons standalone drugstores, including Save-On and Osco, were bought by CVS, a drugstore chain, for $2.9 billion.
An organic material developed to help power cars of the future could also revolutionize wastewater treatment, that according to researchers at Oregon State University. A technology called microbial fuel cells have been used to create electricity or hydrogen from biodegradable organic material. This power-generating technology is viewed as the most practical alternative to gasoline-powered cars and trucks. It turns out that the fuel cell systems can take almost any biodegradable material of slight adaptations. Researchers realized that the fuel cells could be used to produce electricity for waste treatment plants. Because waste treatment plants by definition bring in biodegradable material, using the fuel cells could make the plant self-sufficient for energy. Such energy self-sufficiency could make proper waste treatment much more affordable for developing nations.
Stay tuned for independent native news following our newscast. Then at 6 p.m. here at Labor Radio. At 7 is Time Sound with Kevin Berry. Tonight's weather, partly cloudy with patchy fog, lows 30 to 35 degrees. Tomorrow, mostly sunny with patchy fog in the morning, highs around 50. You're listening to the KBOO Evening News, Portland, Corvallis, Vancouver, and Hood River.
A fish and wildlife technician who lives at the Coyote Valley Dam Fish Facility in Northern California woke up early Friday to find 150 adult trout and about 104,000 10-inch yearlings dead. The 100-by-9-foot concrete raceway in which they were held was drained of water. There are two pumps that bring oxygenated water into the facility. The facility has a flow meter equipped with an alarm to go off if the water floats drop too low. However, it is located in the vault of the city on Ukiah's power-generating plant that flooded during heavy storms earlier this month. Fish facility workers were aware of the problem and had a backup alarm, but apparently it also failed to go off. Brett Wilson, who manages the trapping and imprinting operation, said the loss was significant, representing about half of the 200,000 yearlings that the Coyote facility expected to release this year. But Wilson said the real impact won't be known until 2008, when the adults return. Wilson said he still has another 105,000 young steelhead at Warm Springs that will be released at Coyote Valley over the coming weeks.
As required by state law, counties throughout California have begun issuing ID cards for medical marijuana patients. But the Board of Supervisors of San Diego County has refused to take part in the program, and they're taking things one step further. Last Friday, San Diego County sued the state in federal court in an effort to overturn California's medical marijuana law. From KBPS in San Diego, Kenny Goldberg reports.
The San Diego County Board of Supervisors is made up of five members, all Republicans. The board has a history of fiscal conservatism and has often challenged the state over what it calls unfunded mandates. It's also taken conservative stands on other issues. For example, the board has rejected the idea of launching a clean needle exchange program, saying it would condone illegal drug use. But when it comes to medical marijuana, San Diego supervisors are going on the offensive. They're challenging the legality of California's medical marijuana law in federal court. Board member Diane Jacob represents East San Diego County.
San Diego County has a reputation of making bold decisions. We have stood alone in some of the issues that we have tackled. And sometimes you need to stand up for what you believe in and what you think is right.
San Diego County Council John Sansone says the case is pretty straightforward. He argues it's a matter of federal preemption.
According to our principles of democratic government here in our country, federal law is supreme. So we're going to be asking a court to review this and to determine whether or not, in fact, the federal law that makes the use of marijuana a crime preempts the California state law.
California voters gave the green light to medical marijuana in 1996 when they approved Prop 215. The measure allows patients to use and grow the drug for medicinal purposes with a doctor's permission. Sansone concedes he had some reservations about challenging the law when the board first suggested it.
I did not advise that it would be impossible, that we would lose, but that it would be a difficult undertaking. The more that we have conducted our research, the more confident I'm growing, frankly, in with respect to our chances.
But critics don't see things that way.
I think the county council is blowing a lot of steam, and I think the more interesting question is going to be whether the federal court might actually sanction the county's attorneys for bringing a frivolous lawsuit.
Dan Abrahamson is the director of legal affairs for the Drug Policy Alliance, a group that advocates alternatives to the war on drugs. Abrahamson contends San Diego County's legal position is flawed because the courts have recognized California's right to enact and enforce its own medical marijuana law. What's more, Abrahamson can't understand the county's refusal to comply with California's law requiring the issue of ID cards to medical marijuana patients. He says 15 counties, including conservative-leaning Riverside and Kern, are taking part in the program.
And then San Diego is not just simply dragging its feet, it's erecting obstacles in the way of the program.
The San Diego County Grand Jury has also been critical of the board's position, arguing it should be promoting access to marijuana for patients. That's also the view of Dion Markgraf. He opened San Diego County's first medical marijuana dispensary in 1997. He uses a drug to relieve chronic pain. Markgraf points out a majority of San Diego County residents voted for Prop 215. He says the Board of Supervisors is making a mockery of that vote.
Society says go to the polls, you know, vote. We have done that, and for five people to decide they're more powerful than the whole state, I mean, it's just ridiculous.
But County Supervisor Diane Jacob says critics are off base.
This is not about popular opinion. This is not about a majority of San Diegans or a majority of Californians. It's about the law, and it's about resolving a clash between state and federal laws, and that's all we're trying to accomplish here.
The legal challenge will pit San Diego County against the state of California. Attorney General Bill Lockyer has been a strong supporter of Prop 215, and his office is expected to vigorously defend it. Supervisor Jacob says if the county loses, it will comply with the court's ruling. For the California Report, I'm Kenny Goldberg in San Diego.
Democrats and unions condemn the poor working conditions and slow reaction times that led to the deaths of 14 coal miners in West Virginia this month. Senator Robert Byrd, a Democrat from West Virginia, says the deaths were, quote, entirely preventable. He also criticized the Bush Labor Department, which says it will take weeks to determine why the federal government was not notified for 2 hours after the Sego mine disaster. Byrd said the answer should already be apparent. Senators expressed concerns that budget cuts compromise the miners' safety. They also stressed that there are new technologies available which can make the mine safer and which could keep track of miners' locations. In a press release Sunday, the United Mine Workers urged Congress to make sure existing safety rules and regulations are strictly enforced. The UMW also asked for new rules to, quote, give every miner a vastly improved chance to walk out of a mine after an accident, alive and well and safe in the arms of their loved ones.
United Auto Workers are expressing outrage at today's Ford announcement that the Ford will cut up to 30,000 jobs and idle 14 plants by the year 2012. UAW leaders argued that Ford should focus on building better cars rather than building fewer cars. They criticized the company's management for, quote, failure to halt Ford's sliding market share. Ford CEO Bill Ford admitted the company has not been building the cars that the public wanted. Ford said the automaker has been slow to shift its production mix away from gas-guzzling sport utility vehicles. The 30,000 jobs lost represent one quarter of Ford's North American workforce of 122,000 people. UAW says the laid-off workers will be compensated through a job security program that is part of the union's contract with Ford.
As a Leon County, Florida supervisor of elections, Ian Santro's job is to make sure voting is free of fraud. But the most brazen effort lately to manipulate election results in this Florida locality was carried out by Santro himself. KBOO's Kirk Vanderveer reports.
Four times over the past year, Sancho told computer specialists to break into his voting system. And on all four occasions, they did, changing results with what the specialists describe as relatively unsophisticated hacking techniques. To Sancho, the results showed the vulnerability of voting equipment manufactured by Ohio-based Diebold Election Systems, which is used by Leon County and many other jurisdictions around the country. Diebold and some officials have criticized Sancho's experiments and said his conclusions about the vulnerability of electronic voting systems are unfounded. The questions about electronic balloting have become widespread as states and counties move to upgrade equipment, as required by the 2002 Help America Vote Act. The law and new state regulations were enacted to make voting more accessible and more accurate, a response to the controversy generated by the contested outcome in Florida in the 2000 presidential election. For KBOO News, I'm Kirk Vanderveer.
The current time is 5:20:27. And now for something completely different, daily commentary from Jim Hightower.
George W. just can't seem to get the hang of this democracy thing. He keeps saying democracy is good, but when it's directed at him, he says it's bad, and he suddenly calls for a dollop of autocracy or even monarchy. The latest Bush twist came in a speech to the VFW. He started off talking about how good it is for Americans to have a spirited debate this election year about the war in Iraq. There's no need to fear the debate, he said. Well, yes, freedom of speech, open debate, dissent. These are the essence of democracy, so bring them on. But then he regressed. There is a difference between responsible and irresponsible debate, George warned with an autocratic air, adding that Americans should only tolerate honest critics. Oh? And what does his royal bushness decree irresponsible and dishonest to be? He did not hesitate to draw the line sharply, declaring that those, quote, who claim that we acted in Iraq because of oil or because we misled the American people are irresponsible and dishonest. Allowing such topics to be debated would bring comfort to our adversaries, he said. Holy Richard Nixon, here we go again. America can have a democratic debate as long as it doesn't question the imperial presidency, for to challenge the motivations and rationale of the Bushites' war strategy in Iraq would be unpatriotic and damage the morale of the troops. Bush is trying to control the debate so that his fundamental failures and dishonesty are off limits, branding dissenters as traitors. That's not a debate or democracy. It's autocratic paranoia. This is Jim Hightower saying, shamefully, the Bushites even try to hide behind our soldiers, asserting that Americans must not question their leaders when American troops are risking their lives overseas. Excuse me, but don't the Bushites also claim that our troops are fighting for democracy in Iraq? And doesn't democracy mean that we have every right to question leaders? Today's commentary is made possible in part by the good folks at Mother Jones Magazine. Over the years, Mother Jones has won just about every award available while ticking off the honchos of business and government. They're proud of both distinctions. Find out more at motherjones.com.
22 immigrants from Somalia and Ethiopia have been reported dead and a further 28 missing while trying to reach Yemen aboard a smuggler's boat. The immigrants died when their boat capsized on Saturday in the Gulf of Aden. The boat was carrying about 110 Ethiopians, 10 Somalis, and 5 crew members. Less than a week earlier, 4 Ethiopians and 16 Somalis died while making the crossing from Somalia. The UN Refuge Agency has urged governments to work for combat illegal smuggling. Dozens of Somalis undertake the deadly voyage to Yemen each year.
And that's the KBOO Evening News. And that really was the KBOO Evening News for Monday, January 23rd, 2006. If you have any questions or comments about what you heard this evening, please give us a call at 503-231-8032 and leave a message on extension 203 or send an email to pmnews@kboo.org. You're listening to KBOO at 90.7 FM in Portland, in Corvallis at 100.7 FM on translator K264AA, and in Hood River at 91.9 FM. On translator K220HR. You can log into our website at kboo.fm. Our producer for tonight's newscast is Kirk Vanderveer. Our assistant producer is Steve Casburn. Tonight's audio editor is Noah Eaton. Special thanks to reporters Robinette Jones and Kirk Vanderveer. Our engineer is John Delderfield. The KBOO Evening News and Public Affairs Director is Lisa Loving. And I'm Andy Seaton.
And I'm Noah Eaton. Stay tuned for Independent Native News. And coming up at tomorrow at 7 a.m. here, tomorrow morning at KBOO at 7:30, Joe Uris and our A. Proctor host the Abe and Joe Talk radio show. They'll discuss ethics and government, the Alito nomination, the war in Iraq, and they'll ask the question, where are the Democrats? At 9 on Between the Covers, Andrew Giller speaks with Kim Stanley Robertson, author of 50 Degrees Below, a utopian black comedy and environmental thriller. At 9:30, Words and Pictures features a panel discussion with five Northwest cartoonists who create nonfiction comics. At 10, Michelle Schroeder Fletcher speaks with James Howard Kunster about the long emergency and the end of oil. At 10:30 on stage and studio, the topics are Northwest Children's Theater's A Year with Frog and Toad and Liminal Theater's production on Far Away. And at 11, it's Democracy Now! That's all right here on KBOO, your nonprofit, volunteer-powered, and listener-sponsored community radio station. Thanks for joining us!
This is Free Speech Radio News for Monday, January 23, 2006. I'm Mitch Jezerich in Washington. In today's newscast, both President Bush and Deputy Director of National Intelligence Michael Hayden defend the domestic spying program. Kosovo's President Ibrahim Rugova died on Saturday, leaving a political vacuum as the Albanian government tries to negotiate for its independence. And the state of Washington considers a bill requiring new affordable housing to be built before existing low-income housing can be torn down. All these stories and more after these news headlines.
I'm Shannon Young with the Free Speech Radio News headlines. Canadians are voting today in a special election. Today's election comes after a no-confidence vote caused the collapse of Prime Minister Paul Martin's government last November. Opinion polls predict the Conservative Party will win by a comfortable margin. Senate Democrats are conducting a hearing today into allegations that Halliburton failed to provide safe water to U.S. troops in Iraq. Zachary Jarvinen reports from Washington, D.C.
Details of a memo written by a Halliburton official, William Granger, on July 15th, revealed that both civilian and military base camp populations had been exposed to an untreated and unsafe water source for possibly up to a year. Halliburton has denied the charges. However, their own former water expert, Bing Carter, had already tested and affirmed that the water was, quote, without question contaminated with numerous microorganisms, including coliform bacteria. Carter later resigned from his post after Halliburton officials would not take any action to inform the camp population. Halliburton, formerly headed by Vice President Dick Cheney, received a number of no-bid contracts and has been repeatedly criticized for overcharging and underperforming. For Free Speech Radio News in Washington, D.C., I'm Zachary Jarvinen.
Several explosions in southern Russia early Sunday morning have suspended gas and electricity supplies to Georgia and further strained the already tense relationship between the two countries. From Tbilisi, Deborah Wild reports.
All through the night and into the early morning hours, Georgians are queuing up for gas bottles. The government had announced that it would stop gas distribution for most of the country by Sunday evening. The beginning of the new school term, scheduled for today, has been postponed. Georgians use gas for heating and cooking, but the country has no gas storage and receives all its gas through Russia. President Mikhail Saakashvili is accusing Moscow of being behind these explosions as an attempt to blackmail Georgia. The Russian energy giant Gazprom is interested in buying Georgia's pipeline network in order to supply gas to Turkey. But Washington opposes such a deal, fearing it would make Georgia even more dependent on its northern neighbor. Moscow has discarded the Georgian allegations as hysterical while trying to transport gas to Georgia through an old pipeline from Azerbaijan, which has not been used in years. Estimates as to when gas supplies will be restored vary from days to weeks. Georgians are now preparing for some cold days as snow began to fall. For Free Speech Radio News, and they were wild in Tbilisi, Georgia.
In northeastern India, rebels have claimed responsibility for a series of explosions along an oil pipeline. Vinod Kejos reports.
10 bomb explosions and multiple grenade attacks killed 2 policemen and injured more than 30 people on Sunday in the northeastern Indian state of Assam. The United Liberation Force of Assam, or ULFA, has claimed responsibility for the attacks, saying they have waited too long for the government of India to begin peace talks. The area of India's northeastern states have many nationality groups, and each has their liberation armies to fight what they call Indian occupation. India has been dealing with the insurgency militarily for over 50 years. Some human rights records show more than 200,000 people lost their lives in the liberation movement of the Nagas and Assamese alone. The ULFA and 3 other groups in northeast India have called for a general strike on 26 January, India's Republic Day. The insurgent groups oppose the official celebrations, saying the Indian government is an occupying force. From New Delhi, in India, this is Vinod K. Jose for Free Speech Radio News.
Violence in the Eastern Democratic Republic of Congo has forced tens of thousands of people to flee the region in recent days. The United Nations Refugee Agency, the UNHCR, sent teams to the DRC-Uganda border region over the weekend. The agency estimates that around 20,000 Congolese had recently arrived in the area. Earlier today, 8 Guatemalan peacekeepers were killed during a gunfight with rebels along the Congolese border with Sudan. The acting UNHCR representative in Kampala, Uganda, said today that as many as 2,000 Congolese were returning to their homes, but that the situation is volatile and unpredictable. I'm Shannon Young for Free Speech Radio News.
The Bush administration defended its program of wiretapping U.S. citizens through the National Security Agency, calling it lawful, limited, and necessary. It says that if the program was used prior to September 11th, the attacks may have been thwarted. Our D.C. editor, Leanne Caldwell, reports from Capitol Hill.
Surveilling people inside the United States is done only on those who are suspected of having ties with Al-Qaeda, according to the Bush administration. President Bush defended surveillance activity to a supportive crowd at Kansas State University, saying that he will do whatever it takes to keep the United States safe and secure, calling it a terrorist surveillance program.
Because there's an enemy that still wants to harm the American people. What I'm talking about is the intercept of certain communications emanating between somebody inside the United States and outside the United States.
General Michael Hayden, Deputy Director of National Intelligence and former head of the National Security Agency, or NSA, also defended the program. He oversaw the expansion of domestic spying in 2001. He said that the policies had to change after September 11th because U.S. law protects any person inside the U.S., citizen or visitor, from being surveilled. The days following September 11th, the NSA got approval from their top legal counsel that expanding surveillance to include citizens was legal and constitutional. Yet Hayden was unable and unwilling to explain under which guidelines it was lawful to do so.
These guys are expert on the FISA Act. They're also really expert on the Constitution, and they're really expert on the Fourth Amendment. And so, you know, they weren't freebies. They just didn't hand out hall passes for anything that might have been operationally effective or some things the agency might have wanted to do.
FISA courts were created in 1978 as a quick way for intelligence agencies to obtain a warrant to spy on its citizens. But General Hayden said the FISA courts are less effective and that presidential powers trump the use of FISA.
If FISA worked just as well, why wouldn't I use FISA? There is an operational impact here. And I have two paths in front of me, both of them lawful, one FISA, one the president's authorization, and we go down this path because our operational judgment is it is much more effective.
Last week, the Department of Justice released a white paper defending the information gathering techniques used by the NSA. The 42-page document uses the Supreme Court decision, Hamdi versus Rumsfeld, which ruled that congressional legislation passed in 2001 gave the president executive powers during a time of war. The American Civil Liberties Union has filed lawsuits challenging that, arguing that the government violated the First and Fourth Amendments, which protect freedom of speech and unreasonable search and seizures. John Conyers, ranking Democrat in the House Judiciary Committee, held hearings last week looking into the situation. Jonathan Turley, torture law professor at George Washington University, said the interpretation of presidential power goes beyond anything he's seen in the past.
The problem is that there is no limiting principle to the president's argument that he can effectively trump federal law. He's already said that he could violate the recent torture prohibition or ignore it in the interest of the country. He has said he can do so with a surveillance statute. He has said he can do so with enemy combatant detainees.
Senator Arlen Specter, chair of the Senate Judiciary Committee, will hold hearings investigating the program next month. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Leon Caldwell.
Thousands of anti-abortion activists gathered in Washington, D.C. today to mark the 33rd anniversary of the Roe v. Wade decision. The activists used the gathering to also advocate for the confirmation of Judge Samuel Alito to the Supreme Court and replacing Sandra Day O'Connor, in the hope that Alito will lead the court in further chipping away at a woman's right to choose. The Senate Judiciary Committee will vote tomorrow on his confirmation, and pro-choice activists are engaged in a last-minute effort to convince Democratic senators to filibuster Alito's nomination. Ingrid Drake has more from the Capitol.
Yesterday was the 33rd anniversary of Roe v. Wade, the Supreme Court decision legalizing abortion in the United States. While usually a day of mourning for anti-abortion groups, today their tone was confident that they had the political power to bring about their agenda, especially after a special guest called in live to their event.
The President of the United States.
One of my first acts as the president was to ban the use of taxpayer money on programs that promote abortion overseas.
Today's rally of between 5 and 10,000 people was dwarfed by the 1 million people that assembled for the pro-choice March for Women's Lives in 2004. Yet, the activists were confident that tomorrow, the Senate Judiciary Committee would endorse President Bush's Supreme Court nominee of Samuel Alito, leading to a full Senate vote. Congressman Christopher Smith of New Jersey is confident there will soon be a ban on third trimester abortions.
Before the ink was even dry on the president's signature, an activist federal judge usurped the legislative process and nullified the will of the people. It will likely soon be before the United States Supreme Court. The last time a similar bill was before the Supreme Court, we lost on a 5-4 vote, with Justice Sandra Day O'Connor casting the deciding vote. Well, she's retiring, and President Bush got to pick her replacement.
Alito's nomination can still be defeated, says Elliot Mintzberg, legal director at the People for the American Way.
Something like 1.1 million petition signatures have already been delivered in opposition to Alito, and the number of calls are going up every day. And as grateful as we are for everybody's participation, there's no question, though, that more is needed, given where we are now with a 55-45 Republican advantage, to have a real impact.
Planned Parenthood has coordinated an early morning demonstration in front of the Senate tomorrow. For Free Speech Radio News in Washington, D.C., this is Ingrid Drake.
Bolivia has inaugurated its first indigenous president, Evo Morales, on Sunday. In his inaugural address, Morales pledged to end 500 years of injustice for his people. Morales, who is considered a strong critic of the United States, also reaffirmed his campaign pledge to nationalize the country's natural resources. Morales' victory was also celebrated with a traditional indigenous ceremony on Saturday. On Sunday, his inauguration was attended by an unprecedented number of dignitaries, including Brazil's Luis Ignacio Lula da Silva and Venezuela's Hugo Chavez. Free Speech Radio News' Deletta Varlesi reports from La Paz.
The first inaugural ceremony took place last Saturday in Tiwanaku ruins on the Andean mountains, where Morales received the traditional name as leader of the indigenous nation. It has been 514 years since the ceremony has been celebrated, and in this occasion it was held by four shamans representing the major indigenous populations that make up Bolivia: Aymara, Quechua, and the Guarani of the eastern regions. Valentin Maquillones, the shaman representing the Aymara people, which Morales belonged to, explains the meaning of the ceremony.
This is an offer for the whole world. It's an offer for the indigenous unity and integrity. We'll ask for peace, for harmony, equilibrium, and respect for all the beings existing in the cosmos we live in.
About 30,000 people attended the ceremony, most of them indigenous people, not just from Bolivia, but from North and South American countries as well. Doris Trujillo, an indigenous person from Ecuador, is part of National Assembly of Campesinos.
Within community issues, we are focusing the most on managing local municipalities. And this experience gives us a strength. This is a kind of experience that we can share with other indigenous people and bring as an example. There are municipalities that are working pretty good and are great examples of participative democracy. For instance, Cotacachi community is one of those in which participation is high and so is quality of life.
There were also representatives from North American indigenous community who were directly invited by Morales. They shared a spiritual vision for change foretold by many prophecies belonging to ancient original American cultures. Carol Perez Peterson was present as a representative of Northeastern American communities.
It's a historical moment for all the indigenous people of the world. First of all, that there is a president who understands the suffering of the indigenous people of his country because he lived it himself. And he understands the cultural, the pressures that the indigenous people have, just the difference on the inequality, the lack of respect, the taking of the land, all these things that occur from a dominant way of life that most governments actually have set in motion to control people, to enslave them, and to have them to work for them.
In his speech in Tiwanaku, Morales reaffirmed the intent to be an example of an Indio president, not just for his people, but for all indigenous people in the world.
Today begins a new year for all native people in the world.
On Sunday, at the Congress Palace ceremony, attended by presidents from neighboring countries, including Hugo Chavez, Lula da Silva, and Nestor Kirchner, Bolivia's Vice President Alvaro Garcia Linera marked the intention of a government in which every Bolivian can feel represented, from business people to campesinos.
Never again will there be in Bolivia a state without indigenous people. The state is of everybody, of business people and chain workers, of campesinos and students. We want a strong state, multicultural, where different people, different languages, different interests can be joined together.
From the first time in South America's history, a president has officially been named as brother in a Congress session. From now on, the new administration will have to face the issues that are strongly urging, including nationalizing hydrocarbons and creating an assembly of native people to rewrite the state constitution with no exclusion. For Free Speech Radio News, Diletta Varlese from La Paz, Bolivia.
The president of Kosovo, Ibrahim Rugova, died on Saturday after a six-month battle with lung cancer. He was 61 years old. The pacifist leader of the ethnic Albanian majority for the better part of 15 years, Rugova was considered by many to be a unifying element among an increasingly fractured Albanian-led government that is poised to gain some form of conditional independence in 2006. A UN-run province since the end of ethnic fighting in 1999, Kosovo is still technically part of the former Yugoslav successor state, Serbia and Montenegro. Tensions have elevated with Rugova's death, as the Albanian government must now negotiate its future without firm leadership. From Kosovo's capital of Pristina, Jackson Allers has this report.
For the last 2 days in Pristina, thousands of Albanians throughout the southernmost province of Serbia and Montenegro have been lining up outside the Kosovo Parliament building to pay their respects to President Ibrahim Rugova. Kosovo's Albanian-led government has called for a 15-day mourning period as it tries to decide how it will proceed as a unified negotiating team in ongoing UN-led status discussions. Jeta Jara is a political analyst and head of the Balkan Investigative Reporting Network of Kosovo.
For the international community, the most relevant power struggle and lack of leadership will be for the Kosovo negotiation team, because the international community cares far more to have the stable negotiation process about the status of Kosovo. And the problem for the international community at the moment is that there is nobody so evident to replace his function as the leader of this negotiation group.
Although, as Jara explains, the real negotiating position espoused by the former leader has not changed with his passing.
The pure strategy, Rugova strategy, is not going to change. Everybody, all the Albanians, want independent Kosovo.
A literature scholar, Rugova was the leader of the Albanian nonviolent resistance movement in the 1990s, opposed to the rescinding of certain autonomous rights during the regime of former Yugoslav president Slobodan Milosevic. But members of the former guerrilla movement, the Kosovo Liberation Army, are now jockeying for power in the scramble to lead the Albanian negotiating team in what analysts widely believe will be some sort of conditional independence in 2006, a sure boost of popular power for anyone stewarding the process. Among the things that have been temporarily sidelined as a result of Rugova's death are the reforms of local government that would cede more power to the beleaguered ethnic Serbian minority, a population of approximately 100,000 that stayed in Kosovo following reprisal attacks by the Albanian majority after the end of NATO bombing in 1999. For their part, the Serbian government rejects any talk of independence, and their negotiating team sees the issue of government decentralization as key for the safety of the Kosovo Serbs, who have been subject to 6 years of isolation and ethnically motivated attacks. Milan Nikolic, director of the Belgrade-based Center for Studying Alternatives, said that Rugova's death jeopardizes this local governmental reform process, but he says Serbs see independence as the real thing to fear.
If there is no such provision, probably in case of independence of Kosovo or limited independence, whatever is the case, Serbs would probably move out of Kosovo, given the circumstances of great danger for the Serbs to live and work in Kosovo.
The current Kosovo parliamentary speaker, Nejat Daci, a member of President Rugova's majority political party, was appointed acting president. The negotiation process is set to restart in Vienna in February, and President Rugova's body will lie in state until his funeral on Thursday. Reporting from Pristina, this is Jackson Allers with Free Speech Radio News.
23 people in Nepal were killed, mostly security forces and Maoist rebels, after hundreds of protesters clashed with police over the weekend. The demonstrators are calling on Nepal's king to give up complete authority over the country. It is estimated that as many as 500 people have been arrested. The king has sent about 20,000 soldiers to Kathmandu to stop the protesters. However, opposition leaders are calling for 3 more days of demonstrations. Free Speech Radio News' Carrie Byron is there and files this report.
The situation has deteriorated so much in Kathmandu over the past week that many can't remember the last time things were this bad. After having suffered through yet another security-related nighttime curfew Thursday evening, Kathmandu residents awoke to more bad news on Friday.
The Kathmandu and Lalitpur District Administration imposed curfew from 8 in the morning to 6 in the evening due to security concerns.
This curfew order is additional to the existing curfew order effective in the areas from 9 p.m. to 4 a.m. every day, imposed since January 18 and effective until further notice.
The Nepali government had concerns that soldiers from the country's decade-long Maoist insurgency would use a planned demonstration as cover to sneak into the capital. In fact, days before the rally was set to take place, Maoist leaders confirmed that insurgents had nothing to do with the protest. Nonetheless, government preparations for the demonstration were already going forward, and Thursday morning all phone lines were cut while government forces began mass arrests of political leaders.
They used armed forces, armed police. At the same time, they also use the plainclothes security forces. People were picked up from their bed.
That's Shabakar Budatoki, a human rights worker with the Defend Human Rights Movement of Nepal.
And at the same time, they have been arresting people and detaining for a while in police stations and have been transferring them to the armed police barracks. They are keep transferring the people, and we are not able to track the number of the people. But I would say at least there are hundreds of people still in detention.
Nepal has seen dozens of public pro-democracy rallies held both in and out of the capital since the king dissolved the government in 2002. But several new factors have led to explosive tensions, including 2 Maoist attacks the previous week on police stations on the outskirts of Kathmandu. On Thursday evening, just after the decision was made to impose the daytime curfew, Foreign Minister Ramesh Nath Pandey explained to foreign diplomats the government's rationale.
The political parties have become beholden to the terrorists, as evidenced by the sudden increase in terrorist activities in and around the Kathmandu Valley and in other parts of the country.
But even more worrying for the government than terrorists is a mid-November agreement made between the political parties and the Maoists, who realize they are fighting a common enemy in the king. The regime is now faced with a loosely unified front consisting of not just the Maoists and political parties, but also much of civil society.
Therefore, the movement has gained legitimacy because everyone from jungle to civil society group was supporting the claims of the political parties. Therefore, government was being isolated.
Hari Sharma is a Nepali political scientist.
So government saw that particular attack as an attack on Kathmandu and created a fear psychosis among the people. In that respect, government wanted to mix the violent, the insurgency of Maoist and the peaceful demonstration of political parties.
What Sharma calls a fear psychosis has certainly affected many on the streets of Kathmandu. During the three-hour interlude on Friday between the daytime and nighttime curfews, the vast majority of those interviewed, in fact, claimed support for the curfew, although not necessarily for the king.
Looking at the present condition of our country, I really support the curfew today, because today if there had been no curfew, there could have been anything. There would have been lots of fightings. The condition would be very bad, I think so.
Prashant Swist is a student in Kathmandu.
We have trusted political parties, we have trusted king also, but we didn't find the proper solution. I think we have been fed up of everything. Now what we want right now is the peace. That's what we want. That's it.
On Monday, opposition parties called for three more days of protests. For Free Speech Radio News, this is Carrie Byron in Kathmandu.
With about 20% cuts in subsidies for low-income housing since President Bush took office, affordable housing advocates are beginning to turn to the states for help. An amendment to proposed legislation in the state of Washington called the Affordable Housing for All Act would bar the Seattle Housing Authority from tearing down any low-income housing without first replacing all units at comparable rent. Martha Baskin has our story.
After decades of federal neglect, low-income housing advocates are turning to the state for legislation to prevent high-end redevelopment of one of the city's last remaining federally funded public housing complexes, Yesler Terrace.
Well, we see this bill as incredibly important because it would essentially go over the heads of the housing authority and local city council here.
Kate Villarreal, community organizer with the Community Coalition for Environmental Justice.
If there's support in the state legislature to kind of put these checks and balances on the housing authority, we would be able to, you know, sit back a little bit and we would have that protection in place that would achieve no net loss of housing here at Yesler Terrace, no displacement of residents, all the goals that we've been trying to negotiate for over the past 2 years.
The mission of public housing agencies to solely serve low-income populations began to change under Ronald Reagan. By 1995, under Clinton, redevelopment rules for replacing such housing were significantly altered to allow mixed use and high-end development. The ongoing trend has meant that federal housing subsidies originally earmarked for low income have been made available to housing authorities for market rate real estate development. Recent redevelopment of four Seattle public housing communities resulted in an estimated loss of 1,000 public housing units, according to John Fox with the Seattle Displacement Coalition.
We cannot afford to lose this public housing, and that's what SHA wants to do, is destroy it and replace it with expensive development, leaving only about probably roughly half or less the number of units that are currently there, public housing, low-income housing units.
Low-income housing advocates have been battling the Seattle Housing Authority, one of 200 across the country, for years. They turned to the state after failing to receive adequate support from the city council. The Housing Authority is lobbying the legislature to halt proposed language in the housing bill specific to Yesler Terrace. The Housing Authority's Virginia Felton.
The constraints that it would place on us would mean that we couldn't replace it unless it was replaced on site exactly as it is within 1 year, and that's makes it for an impossible constraint.
Felton says such a law would prevent the agency from accessing an array of funding, tax credit funding, bonds, state housing levies. She says the agency is in the process of replacing every unit of public housing that was lost in redeveloping other public housing communities. But Fox says the root of the problem is that the housing authority is tapping into existing low-income housing stock to rebuild units they tear down, rather than expanding the stock by building more low-income units.
Agencies across the country are doing this. Here in Seattle, though, we want to put a stop to the view of our housing authority that this is nothing but a piece of capital, that these units can be converted, torn down, redeveloped, turned into high-end condos.
Yesler Terrace is one of Seattle's few remaining public housing communities. Built as a shining jewel of what the New Deal could do for the less fortunate, the valuable public housing is perched on a hill overlooking downtown with panoramic views of Mount Rainier and the Olympic Mountains. Resident Audrey Breaux says the Housing Authority wants Yesler Terrace for the people that work downtown.
Well, you can just walk down the hill, ride the bus till the freeze on, get off and walk home. See, but it's not fair to the low-income families. And it's taken me a while to get here in this Yester Terrace. It's taken me over 30 years. They can upgrade it, but don't tear it down. Because if they do, we never would be back in here.
The issue is bound to remain heated as the city's demand for affordable housing continues to grow. For Free Speech Radio News, this is Martha Baskin in Seattle.
Free Speech Radio News is an independent program. Filling in for Aldo Bogado, I'm Mitch Jezerich in Washington.
This is Independent Native News for Monday, January 23rd, 2006. I'm Robert Hannon in for Bonnie Sue Hitchcock. Connecticut Shattuck Tribe is filing a lawsuit in federal court. It challenges the revocation of its recognition by the U.S. Bureau of Indian Affairs. WSHU's Ebong Udama reports.
Shattuck Chief Richard Velke says his tribe filed the lawsuit because it suspects Connecticut officials had an undue influence on the federal recognition process.
No documentation from our opposition was ever submitted, so they can say by evidence we can reverse this decision. So it's yet to be seen why it happened.
Attorney General Richard Blumenthal denies any wrongdoing by state officials. He says recognition for the Shattuck was overturned because of deficiencies in their application.
The state has fought hard and fair against a recognition petition that failed to meet the legal test, both factually and legally. This petition failed to meet the established criteria, and that's the reason that the Department of Interior ruled as it did.
State officials say they are against federal recognition for the Shattuck because recognition would allow the tribe to establish another Indian casino in Connecticut. In Fairfield, Connecticut, I'm Ebong Udama.
The California governor's race is heating up, and the issue of who is going to take campaign contributions from tribes in the state is on the table. Ellen Cherchak has more from Sacramento.
Most political candidates on the state and local level see no problem with accepting campaign contributions from tribes. In the 2003 governor's recall election, candidate Lieutenant Governor Cruz Bustamante accepted a $2 million donation from a Southern California tribe. But Governor Arnold Schwarzenegger has said he won't take any donations from tribes because he has to negotiate with them on casino compacts and he sees a conflict of interest there. His two Democratic opponents do not. Speaking on his cell phone, State Controller Steve Wesley says he does accept contributions from tribes.
I'm proud of the support that I've received from California tribes, and I look forward to working with them as governor in a mutually respectful government-to-government relationship.
Democratic candidate and state treasurer Phil Angelides also accepts contributions from tribes. Republican Schwarzenegger has said Indian tribes are becoming too powerful a special interest in the state. It's still too early to tell how powerful their influence will be in the November 2006 governor's race. I'm Ellen Cherchak in Sacramento.
Native history is full of stories of forced relocation and cultural decimation that leads to trauma, depression, and despair. Families and entire communities can suffer what is now termed generational grief. It's a concept gaining recognition as a root cause of a social, cultural, and spiritual void in Native communities. Lori Townsend has more.
Dr. Vianne Nations is a psychologist working for the Copper River Native Association. She says there is increasing medical evidence that shows how feelings of sadness can be passed on generationally. Dr. Nations says helping Native people develop emotional well-being must not only encompass dealing with their own life experiences, but trauma that happened to their ancestors as well.
When we're looking at mental health treatment, substance abuse treatment, we can look at treating the individual, but it also has to go back to the recent events in history.
Nations says the loss of parental guidance during long absences at boarding schools and other forced separations resulted in a loss of Indigenous language that impacts entire communities.
And we know now through a lot of neuroscience kinds of research that culture is transmitted through language, and if we don't learn some things through language, sometimes there are no other concepts. So those things are learned through the language. So when people lost the language, they lost the culture, they lost the ability to parent, connect with their children.
Nation says generational grief hampers a person's ability to deal with even average pressures at school, work, or while parenting. But she says Native people are now finding help for emotional growth and healing through the naming, understanding, and treatment of inherited despair and grief. For Independent Native News, I'm Lori Townsend.
This is Independent Native News. I'm Robert Hannon.
Supported by Sanosky Chambers Law Firm of Albuquerque, San Diego, Anchorage, Juneau, and Washington, D.C., defending Native American interests since 1976. Independent Native News is a production of KUAC at the University of Alaska Fairbanks.